Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last approximately 1 hour. We'll start with a clinical pearl and then move into studies, case studies and questions that you have submitted. And then I'll go over some interesting published papers that I would like to bring to your attention. I will also pause throughout the call to allow you to make comments, ask questions, share your experience and knowledge with us. This is to be an interactive call. If you would like to unmute your microphone, then just press *7 and that will unmute you, and then you can speak up and we'll all hear you and we can have a dialogue. So I'll get started tonight. It's the middle of summer, and this happens every year. Usually, there's few questions and case studies in July for some reason, and so we didn't have any case studies or questions submitted. So because of that, when we open this up for questions, you know, we can really talk about anything that anybody's interested in talking about. And I see that Judy's here, so I'll bet you'll have something you want to talk about, Judy, and I'm so glad to see you. So once again, we have people from all parts of the country, nobody from out of the country yet, but often we do. So let me go ahead and start with my clinical pearl for this evening. And remember that you should have gotten in your inbox a copy of the slides in PDF form and also the preliminary notes for this call, so that if you want to follow along with me as I'm teaching, you can have these to look at, and then the final copies of these will be uploaded to the course library for your reference, and then you'll have the recording as well if you want to listen to it again. So the topic I chose is herbal compounds that inhibit tumor-promoting oncogene mTOR. mTOR stands for mammalian target of rapamycin. You'll see it's published as little m, capital T, capital O, capital R. And it's the subject of quite a lot of research, active research in cancer care today. And I chose this because mTOR as an oncogene is active in a large number of cancers. And because also we have a huge materia medica in botanic medicine that inhibits this oncogene. And so it's really important to know what the big levers are that we have in our medicine that really can turn off an oncogene, because that's what all oncologists want to do. And so when you find these genes that are common to so many cancers, then you know that it has a big impact. So that's what I really want to teach you about tonight, and to sort of give you, plant the seed of looking for where these big pathways are, where we have a lot of tools in our treatment toolbox, our materia medica, to influence these pathways in non-toxic ways over long periods of time. So that's also what we want to really be looking for when we're working with cancer survivors, because quite often the oncologist sort of just waits and watches and surveils the patient and hopes they don't get a recurrence. But our job is really to continue to influence these pathways safely so that we can put together a botanic nutraceutical program that will allow patients to actually have control over their tumor microenvironment in ways that the oncologist absolutely doesn't have. So these are powerful and important, hence my choice of this topic. So on the second slide, I want to talk about what is mTOR and then actually what does it regulate, and you'll see why it's so important. So it is a protein kinase. Remember, protein kinases sit in the cell membrane, and they actually, there's a receptor on the cell surface, and then there's also a binding site inside the cell. And so they actually are transducers of information, and they turn on big pathways. And so it's a big signaling molecule. So the mTOR, when it becomes activated, all tyrosine kinases add a phosphorus group, and so they are involved in phosphorylation. And so this particular protein kinase mTOR will phosphorylate both tyrosine as well as serine and threonine. So what that means is it affects more pathways, basically. And so that also means that if we can inhibit it, we affect more pathways. And again, I want to emphasize, when you have something in your treatment plan that can influence mTOR expression, you are doing something very powerful. And I always look for the big levers. Again, I want to make sure that the things we have certainty about and the things that make the most difference to the patients are what we're including in our treatment plans. And again, I'm going to show you all the herbs shortly. So mTOR functions in normal physiology as well, but it is really active in, overexpressed, overactive in the majority of cancers. And I have a slide on which cancers it's known to be most active in momentarily. Now, what does mTOR do? What kind of oncogenic signaling is going on here? Remember the hallmarks of cancer. Go back to that lecture. It's a really important lecture in the earlier part of the course that really should have a handle on this concept that the hallmarks of cancer are describing known characteristics of tumor cells that are the strategies of tumor cells to co-opt our own normal physiology to survive, to proliferate, to metastasize. And so if you really understand those hallmarks of cancer, then you'll understand all the pieces that you want to put in a treatment plan as well. And so an oncogene like mTOR is affecting many of those things that are about cell survival, these strategies, characteristics of tumor cells. So mTOR will regulate growth factors that are signaling proliferation. mTOR will also regulate nutrient metabolism, meaning the Warburg effect, meaning that metabolic shift that allows cancer cells to adapt and shift into glycolysis over the Krebs cycle, over oxidative phosphorylation. mTOR also promotes protein, lipid, and nucleotide synthesis. So it turns on a lot of synthetic gene pathways that help cancer cells to be more efficient. It also very much promotes angiogenesis and metastasis. So when you have a patient who already is in stage 3 or 4, then you're wanting to include things in that treatment plan that inhibit angiogenesis and metastasis. And there are many things that we use. One of the things I always think about is modified citrus pectin. It's one of the most powerful things that you can use to inhibit metastasis as well. So think about what you can put in a treatment plan that covers the most bases. mTOR will also inhibit autophagy. And so again, like apoptosis, autophagy is another method of cell suicide. An intelligent cell is supposed to recognize when it's aberrant and destroy itself and recycle. And of course, cancer cells lose their ability to recognize themselves as aberrant, and therefore they continue to divide and proliferate. So we want to inhibit apoptosis, we want to inhibit autophagy. When we inhibit mTOR, we can interfere with this cell survival strategy that tumor cells employ. Now, paradoxically, mTOR also promotes immunity, and so I'm going to talk about that, this paradox about mTOR, and it also activates insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, the receptor for that, and the insulin receptor. So that tells us it's very much involved in glycemic control and insulin signaling. And interestingly, a lot of diabetic drugs on the market are involved in mTOR pathways because of the impact of mTOR on diabetes and insulin. So diabetics get a double benefit from inhibiting mTOR. Now, on the third slide in this lecture, I have an infographic that shows you a cell membrane with the tyrosine kinase receptor in the cell membrane. So imagine that is mTOR there. And when that gets a phosphorus added to it, it activates the pathways that are below it. And so the primary pathway that gets activated here is the PI3K-AKT pathway. And that is also involved in most cancers. And we have a very big armamentarium to inhibit this. So you might see when you're reading papers, you might see the mTOR pathway emphasized. You might see PI3K-AKT emphasized. It's one pathway. Now, what we're wanting to do is change signaling and change gene expression. The power of botanic medicine is that it can change gene expression. Now, we want to be looking for interventions that are inhibitors of the tumor promoter oncogene mTOR. Part of the regulation of this pathway is another gene called PTEN, P-T-E-N. And I have a whole nother lecture on how to promote PTEN. So PTEN is a tumor suppressor and mTOR is a tumor promoter. And so if we can influence both of those, we can really alter the ability of cancer cells to survive and proliferate and metastasize. So again, I always want to address this pathway because it's so powerful. When you do that, you will then inhibit metastatic progression, and you will also inhibit resistance to certain therapies. mTOR is involved in early resistance to chemotherapy and radiotherapy and some immunotherapy. So again, summarize, we're going to look for things to suppress the oncogene, the tumor promoter gene mTOR, and we're going to look for things to promote the tumor suppressor gene PTEN. And we'll focus on mTOR in this lecture. Now, the fourth slide in this is titled Treating Breast Cancer by Targeting the mTOR Pathway. And today, there are a handful of drugs that are being used in breast cancer, and I'll go through, and other cancers, because this pathway is so important, they have a lot of side effects. So they're usually used later on when there's been resistance to other more standard treatments. But I want you to know what they are so that if you can see that a patient has responded to one of these drugs and then they're finished with their course of treatment, then you would know that addressing that pathway with our botanicals and nutraceuticals would also be powerful for that patient. All right. And I forgot to mention that there's another really major pathway in cancer cells, the MAPK pathway, that mTOR can activate. And then there are a couple of genes that you'll see being tested for today in many tumor studies, RAS, R-A-S, MEK, M-E-K, and E-R-K as well. And so when you see that those genes are overexpressed in a pathology report of a tumor cell, then you can go to these herbs as well that we're going to discuss because they have similar places where they intervene in the pathway to turn that oncogene proliferative pathway off. Now, on the fourth slide here is simply a nice infographic that shows you that mTOR, once it gets turned on, it then turns on a lot of protein synthesis. So remember, functional proteins are the products of genes. And so once this gene gets turned on, it doesn't just make one functional protein, it makes quite a lot. But they lead to some of the characteristics of tumor cells that we want to exert control over with our treatment plans. So mTOR will increase the expression of functional proteins that promote the cell cycle, starting with cyclin D1. And so remember, there's a lot of chemotherapy agents that inhibit cell cycling, and those are often drugs that also inhibit mitosis that prevent cell division. So we have this one category of cell growth and cell proliferation that is promoted by mTOR and that we can inhibit by using the botanicals that inhibit mTOR. Also, we can see that hypoxia-inducible factor 1A, which is the trigger for initiating angiogenesis and then leads to the production of vascular endothelial growth factor, platelet-derived endothelial growth factor, and also fibroblast growth factor and angiogenic factor 1. And so all of these active proteins are turned on by mTOR. So you can begin to see why it's so powerful to turn mTOR off. There's a fourth pathway that has to do what I previously mentioned, bioenergetics or cell metabolism, mitochondrial function, how cells make and use energy. And so that's, you know, when we think about the ketogenic diet, we're trying to alter how cells use energy and leverage the vulnerabilities of cancer cells. So there are glycolytic enzymes and that allow the more efficient use of glucose for cells where mTOR is turned on. And also you get this upregulation of the Warburg effect and this transformation of cells into being more glycolytic and glucose hungry. And so that's also why mTOR influences diabetes, as I previously said. And then the fourth category that mTOR turns on functional proteins are all these survival pathways. So we previously mentioned apoptosis and autophagy. These are turned off, the intelligence of the cell to stop dividing and recycle itself and not keep proliferating as an aberrant cell. So that gets turned off by mTOR as a survival mechanism of a tumor cell. And also DNA repair is changed. And so cells that have mTOR active are more efficient at repairing their DNA, and therefore they can proliferate. So you can see how powerful this is. There's these four main areas of the hallmarks of cancer that mTOR actually influences, and multiple functional proteins. So if you go far enough upstream to turn off mTOR, you have a lot of influence on cancer cell physiology and the tumor microenvironment. So just to summarize, mTOR turns on the synthesis of functional proteins that are involved in cell growth and proliferation, angiogenesis, bioenergetics, meaning mitochondrial function, and survival mechanisms. And so, again, that's why I think it's so important to be thinking about how we can include things to inhibit mTOR in our treatment plan. So I just want to give you a list of mTOR active or cancers where mTOR is frequently active. And so just so you understand, it's most of the patients we see: brain cancers, breast, endometrial, ovarian, neuroendocrine, pancreatic, gastric, colorectal, thyroid, prostate, renal, hepatic, melanomas, myelomas, lymphomas, and leukemias. So you can see it's not just solid tumors. It's also the melanomas, myelomas, lymphomas, and leukemias. And so it's really important to understand the depth and breadth of the impact of addressing this pathway. Now, the next slide is something I think is very interesting, and that is the fact that calorie restriction and intermittent fasting also turn off mTOR. So when we ask our patients to do intermittent fasting, we are sending a signal to inhibit mTOR. So carbohydrate restriction, low glycemic diets, intermittent fasting, calorie restriction, that therefore then lower glucose and lower insulin signaling, lower expression of insulin-like growth factor, change the insulin receptors, change the insulin-like growth factor receptors. And when you do all of that by being low glycemic and intermittent fasting, you turn off this PI3K, AKT, mTOR pathway. So we don't even have to give somebody something in a bottle. We can give them a diet that keeps their glucose and insulin low, a low glycemic, low carbohydrate diet. And we can teach them how to do intermittent fasting. And just as a review, I encourage all of my patients to do intermittent fasting. And the easiest way to do that is to have 13 to 16 hours between tonight's dinner and tomorrow's breakfast. And most people can do a 13-hour fast. It just means eating dinner a little earlier or eating breakfast a little bit later and being mindful to just have non-caloric fluids during that fasting window before you go to sleep. So it's really not hard to implement. It's a great lifestyle practice, whether you have the challenge of cancer or not, because that time of intermittent fasting actually turns on certain immune factors. And it also is very good for people who have metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes. It can actually reverse those over time. And so intermittent fasting is a really great lifestyle habit. I'm a very big proponent of it. Walter Longo is the little darling of longevity and cancer research and intermittent fasting. And he wrote a book called The Longevity Diet for Patients. And his research is very, very solid. And there are YouTube videos all over the internet of him being interviewed. He's quite a wonderful lecturer, both to academic audiences, medical audiences, as well as to the general public. Some of you may be aware of his product ProLon, which is a 5-day calorie-restricted fast that he's designed to change some of these metabolic switches. He does caution that anyone over 60 is in danger of losing muscle mass if they do extreme fasting. And that's why I will recommend just the 13 to 16 hour fast in the evening. That's quite safe for anyone. And so we just want to make sure during the eating phase that our patients are getting adequate nutrition and calories during the time that they're eating, because otherwise they will lose weight if they just think they're not supposed to eat. And I have the experience with many of my patients when I ask them to take the carbs out and then put in more fat and be on a higher fat, lower carb diet, moderate protein, that's the OutSmart Cancer guidelines. Then some patients take out the carbs, but they don't put back in enough healthy fats because people aren't really used to eating a lot of healthy fats. And so patients can start to feel hungry or lose weight. And that they tell you that, and you've told them to eat low carb. It's usually because they aren't getting enough calories because they didn't put healthy fats in. So we give patients clear instructions about where to get those calories from fats. And we tell them things, you know, like avocados and ghee and coconut oil. And often we'll put MCT oil and things. Nut butters, hummus, things like that, more olive oil on their vegetables than they would typically use. And so we find that quite a lot of patients get into trouble. And our patients, of course, are already at risk for sarcopenia and cachexia. So we don't want to do that to them. Hence, I have a wonderful coach in my practice who helps patients learn, go on that learning curve and implement it. All right. So we have this very important pathway. It's present in most tumor cells. We can exert influence on this oncogene by inhibiting it through intermittent fasting, carbohydrate restriction. And let me summarize some of the other effects, and then we're going to go through a long list of botanicals that influence this pathway. So I want to bring to your attention on the next slide this paradoxical fact of mTOR's functions. And what's very interesting is depending on the physiologic microenvironment, the signaling environment, mTOR will behave differently. So if you are in an immune-suppressed tumor environment, or if you have an infection, there's a proliferation of microorganisms that shouldn't be there, mTOR will promote immunity and inhibit these proliferative pathways. On the other hand, if mTOR finds itself in an environment where antigen stimulus is the trigger in the environment, then it will be used to regulate transplant organ rejection. So it turns off the immune system in a high antigen environment like that. So there's two classes of patients that are treated with mTOR inhibitors. mTOR inhibitors are given to people who've had organ transplants. Usually I see it mostly in liver transplant patients. And paradoxically, these inhibitors are also used to turn off proliferation in tumor cells. So it's the signaling environment that determines the gene expression. But this is how all biosystems work. And so if we are cognizant of the tumor microenvironment and understand how that environment is a signaling environment, how can we intervene with that and either promote or turn off different signaling? And so that's really the premise of our system, which I call the OutCart Smart Cancer System, but it is the framework of integrative oncology to not just be focused on the tumor itself, but to be understanding the signaling environment that changes the behavior of tumor cells and changes the behavior of our immune system. And so we have to understand which environment we're in order to skillfully plan an intervention for our patients. So let me give you a summary of the immune modulatory impact of inhibiting mTOR. So turn mTOR off, we get enhanced anti-tumor response. We get a reduction of immunosuppressive and pro-growth activity in fibroblasts, stem cells, and macrophages, and also we get an inhibition of PD-L1 immune suppression. So we can say in the era of immunotherapy that if we have a patient on a PD-L1 inhibitor, we could amplify the effect of that therapy that their oncologist has chosen for them by giving them botanicals that also inhibit mTOR. So that would amplify the immunotherapy response. There are other things we can do in that setting as well. So we could use something like astragalus to amplify immune response. And so there are ways that we can work synergistically with therapies that the oncologist is using. So you want to think about that as well, because there's not really interference. Now, the other impact that we get from inhibition of mTOR that is beneficial to immunity is that we improve foreign antigen recognition and dendritic cell function. Remember, dendritic cells help to make recognizable responses to specific vaccine-like sort of immune responses to foreign organisms, viruses, bacteria, but also transplanted organs. So if you have a transplant patient that you're treating, you might think of using an mTOR inhibitor. And then our big lever, the most important thing, and the whole really big idea of this lecture is when we inhibit mTOR, we downregulate the PI3K mTOR AKT pathway. And that is a hugely powerful thing to do. So let's look at all the things in our toolbox that allow us to do that. I do have a slide for those of you who are more visual that shows the immune modulatory activity in multiple pathways. And so if you're more visual, I have a slide there for you that is an example, a visual example of the 4 points I just went over. Now, the next 3 slides are all of the things in our Materia Medica that inhibit mTOR. And this could have been a longer list. So I've given you a number of botanicals and phytochemicals and the type of neoplasm that is known to be most impacted in terms of the mTOR pathway, and I've also given you references for each item on these 3 charts. So on the first one, you'll see lots of value in using curcumin as an mTOR inhibitor in multiple cancers, colorectal, prostate, uterine sarcomas. There's also there's one study on combining curcumin and EGCG, the green tea catechin, in uterine sarcomas, EGCG by itself, and also from licorice root, that's glycyrrhiza, the isoquercetin. And that, interestingly enough, is for a very rare cancer, adenoid cystic carcinoma. My son-in-law actually has that cancer. It's very rare, and and there's very few things that work on it. So when you find something for a cancer like that, you want to make sure it's part of the plan. The next slide continues, shows that salicylicide, which is one of the main phytochemicals in rhodiola, is very active in mTOR expression in bladder cancer. And of course, I like to use rhodiola as well because it's such a wonderful adaptogen. And I always like to think about having something to address the inherently stressful experience that cancer diagnosis and cancer care is. So again, we're always looking for multitaskers with the curcumin. We know that curcumin interacts with over 100 pathways, super anti-inflammatory, turns on and off a number of genes, also will inhibit platelet aggregation and protect patients from thrombotic events. So we want to be thinking about which niches in our treatment plan a certain phytochemical will fit many, so we don't have to use so many things in a plan. On slide two, the next entry is ursolic acid, one of my absolutely favorite phytochemicals. And I used to get this as a powdered isolate, and it's just very hard to get and super expensive now. But it's worth noting that ursolic acid is sourced from most salvia species. Remember that we use salvia, miltiariza, danshen in a lot of our treatment plans. It is one of my favorite Chinese herbs because, again, it's very much of a multitasker. It interacts with many pathways. I use it primarily in patients who have high risk of fibrosis and thrombosis. It's really protective to those patients. And so you think about the cancers where hypercoagulation is more common, breast cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer. And so you're going to want to, in those patients, have more emphasis on managing hypercoagulation, protecting people by putting in these botanicals like curcumin, like red sage, the danshen salvia, to protect them. But then there's all these anti-tumor effects and then this oncogene suppression effect with mTOR. And then another herb I use in almost all my Chinese herb formulas for patients where we need tumor control is Oldenlandia. And that's actually oleander. And we all know that oleander is toxic. We don't want children near it in our gardens. It is an ornamental in Mediterranean climates where I live. So you have to know it's poisonous to little children and animals and things. But it's so powerful. And the study here is reference to breast cancer, but it has a wide spectrum of application. I will use the salvia miltiariza and the Oldenlandia and almost all of my formulas for tumor control. It'll be in there somewhere. And then you'll see the next phytochemical here is Witharin A, which is from ashwagandha. And so if you look at the first entry on this slide, which is salicylicide from rhodiola, and then we see ashwagandha, the withania on this list, then we can see, wow, we could actually help a patient who is having more duress and is more fatigued and less resilient and more stressed, has an upregulated HPA axis. We could give them the ashwagandha and the rhodiola and also get this mTOR inhibition effect from it. So, you know, you want to pick the combination of things that is most suited to the patient before you. The next entry here is libanin, which is from milk thistle. And I love milk thistle because it's also so anti-inflammatory, and it is also very good for protecting the liver, the kidney, the heart, and the neurons from the adverse effects of chemotherapy agents where there's a high oxidative stress, like, for example, the platinum drugs, which are widely used, right? Oxaliplatin, carboplatin, cisplatin. So they'll cause oxidative stress, adverse effects in these major organs. So not only will milk thistle protect those organs from oxidative damage, it also has anti-tumor and anti-inflammatory activity. And now you know it also inhibits mTOR. So you can love milk thistle even more than you did before. Apigenin is the next on this list. The primary sources that are parsley and chamomile. That's the penicillium and Matricaria there. I often tell people to put fresh parsley in their shakes because, as you know, I always include a therapeutic shake in my treatment plans as an insurance policy for nutrient repletion and as a way to cut down the number of capsules I have to give them by putting powders into their shake. So we can see that ipagenin is active against a multiplicity of cancers: prostate, breast, colon, cervical, lung, ovarian, skin, liver, pancreas, and hematologic cancer. So that's just about everybody. And so, again, you know, just encouraging people to eat more parsley in their diet. Also, that it's a one little sprig on your plate from a restaurant is not a vegetable serving. So can teach people how to eat more herbs in their diet. I have an herb garden, a culinary herb garden, and I actually use the herbs as greens in my salad. So you can encourage patients to do that. Genistein is also on this list as an mTOR inhibitor. We know that genistein is one of our great isoflavone multitasker phytochemicals. Pinocchiol, one of my absolute favorite phytochemicals from Chinese magnolia bark, and it is not only an inhibitor of mTOR, but it is also a promoter of P10. So that's these two poles of this pathway where you can turn off the tumor promoter mTOR and turn on the tumor suppressor P10. And you will see in pathology reports that P10 is not expressed. And that's a patient who's lost the tumor suppressor gene expression. So then we want to put in a phytochemical like pinocchiol and try to get that switch to our gene expression turned on. And so I really love pinocchiol because it's so powerful and coming in both directions from this proliferative impact of mTOR. So I'll put that in. And also, pinocchiol is nice to give to patients at night because it also, its traditional use in botanic medicine is as a sedative. And you will also see it in a lot of formulas that are for helping patients regulate their HPA, hypothalamic pituitary axis, who are always sympathetic dominant. And so, of course, cancer patients can be in that category. So you get this wonderful effect also of down regulation of stress and the ability to relax and have a good night's sleep. So you'll also see it in some sleep formulas. Now, if we go to the next slide, resveratrol is on this list, works in a multiplicity of cancers. Bicaline is on this list, which is from another one of my most favorite Chinese medicinals, which is Huang Qin, Scutellaria bicalensis. And in modern Chinese herbalism, this botanical will be found in almost all anti-tumor formulas. And it is a rich, rich source of berberine, which makes it also super anti-inflammatory, and berberine also helps the microbiome to be healthier. It's antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, and blood sugar regulating. It acts similarly to glucophage or metformin, and so I'll use it in people with metabolic syndrome as well. We have quercetin, which is rich in so many plants. You know, quercetin is ubiquitous in a lot of food plants as well. It's in green tea and all the cruciferous vegetables and garlic and all the berries. And similarly, you'll find it in things that are berries in our Materia Medica, like hawthorn berry and schizandra berry, for example. Anything that's red or purple has some quercetin in it. So blackberries and blueberries and purple onions and purple cabbage, those all have a lot of quercetin in them. So nature will tell you. So that's also why we tell our patients to eat the rainbow. Urolithin is found not only in pomegranate, but it's also rich in a lot of berries. It's really high in raspberries and in currants. And so again, when we just tell our patients to eat the rainbow, they're going to get signaling to turn off oncogenes, including mTOR. And pomegranate is used in a lot of cancers, particularly estrogenic cancers as well. And so then we see this connection between urolithins, pomegranate, breast cancer, mTOR. So This is how you sort of put this together in your mind. In this study, pancreatic cancer was seen to be impacted in this way by the urolithins from pomegranate. Vitamin D is on this list. Vitamin D is an mTOR inhibitor. So when we optimize vitamin D, remember we're shooting for about 70 nanograms per milliliter. That is optimal for a cancer patient. Then we're also getting mTOR inhibition. As I mentioned, carbohydrate and calorie restriction. And then finally, omega-3 fatty acids have some mild inhibition of mTOR. So that's a really big list. Like, and those are things you can use in your treatment plans and use with lots of patients for lots of other reasons. So if you want to emphasize more mTOR inhibition, you might put more of those herbs and phytochemicals and maybe increase the dosing if you want to be more aggressive. That's the Materia Medica. And then the final slide is a slide of medications, targeted drugs that are in use today in oncology, both for the many cancers in which mTOR, the PI3K, AKT, mTOR pathway is activated. And you'll see this on pathology reports and tumor studies now. And that means that in conventional oncology, that those patients are a candidate for these drugs. However, some oncologists just assume that that pathway is activated because it's so common. And so if they can get insurance company reimbursement for one of these drugs, they'll often then include it. But you will see this in many patients now. But I want to bring to your attention the extreme adverse effects of patients on these drugs. They tend to have a lot of stomatitis and mucositis, really bad mouth sores. I mean, not mild, bad. They get lung inflammation. They get skin rashes. They get diabetes temporarily while they're on the drug. They get immune suppressed and they get myelosuppressed. And these are not mild adverse effects in most patients. These are pretty extreme adverse effects. It's also my experience that people become magnesium deficient on these drugs. And so I always monitor their red blood cell magnesium. I'm also, in any patient where myelosuppression is an adverse effect, I'm tracking, doing a CBC and a differential and a platelet on them. And also I'm watching their liver function and their glycemic control on their labs, because some of these patients get really hyperglycemic. And so then we might think about, you know, giving them more berberine in their treatment plan, which also inhibits mTOR, and really teaching them how to eat a low glycemic diet, because this could be a person who was never diabetic and never had glycemic issues, suddenly is diabetic because of the drug they're on, and they don't really understand that they need to really restrict their carbs. So they need our patient teaching for that, because these drugs work really well. Although that they have such adverse effects, they're hard for patients to take. So I am going to stop there. That is my clinical pearl lecture for this evening. And I took a little more time with it because we have time tonight. So I'm going to stop talking and allow you to unmute yourself by pressing *7. And you can talk about anything I lectured about or anything else you want to talk about, because we have a more open program tonight. So anybody have any comments or questions? Judy, I knew it.
Oh, you called me out. That's why. it's very interesting. I just have a new patient coming in, and I haven't seen her, so I can't really tell you, but I'm excited about hopefully writing up a case study for next month. And she had brain cancer, and she's got extreme dermatitis because uh-huh. she's had little. What are they called? Where they're on her skull, and it's a reaction to both the adhesion, they think, and also to the chemotherapy. Uh-huh. But how it's entering is through the skull.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any history of this?
I actually haven't seen that. I mean, I've seen a lot of changes in the cranium and the bones of uh-huh. patients, you know, who have bone mets. So is this a bone metastasis or like a glioblastoma?
No, patient? I don't. Again, I haven't seen her.
You don't know.
So it, maybe I should just wait till the case study comes in. But I just thought I'd put it out there in case you said, "Oh yeah, extreme dermatitis."
That's usually from the tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So I wonder if they're doing some unusual treatment, or maybe it is a breast cancer patient with brain metastasis.
No, you know, I don't think it was. I think it was. It came in as brain. Yeah.
Uh huh. Well, it'll be an interesting case then. You know.
There you go.
Okay. All righty. Thank you, Judy. Anybody else want to unmute and chime in? Nope. Oh, there's somebody.
Hi, Dr. Choco.
Hi. Who's that?
This is Anna. I am.
Hi, Anna. Yeah, I can see her from in Ontario, but I can't see your name on my screen.
Yeah.
Okay, what's up?
So I have a question regarding mTOR and cachexia. So from my understanding, it can be anabolic and catabolic. So if someone is on mTOR inhibitors, so as you've mentioned, many cancer patients, once they're becoming more resistant, mTOR inhibitors are one of those therapies that would be kind of more towards the end.
Yes.
How does
yes.
this promote cachexia? So this would be, so if they're inhibiting mTOR, and mTOR also has anabolic properties, so building skeletal muscle, preserving mass, so if they're inhibiting mTOR, are they not also accelerating progression to cachexia, which is commonly seen in more aggressive, those end stages when they are on these aggressive mTOR inhibitors with all the side effects that you've noted as well? So at that point, where would the herbal formulations that inhibit the mTOR come in? Would that be an amplifying effect of cachexia, or does the mTOR by inhibition then become anabolic? I'm confused at that point between the anabolic and catabolic. Where is that fine line?
So I'll just tell you my experience, and then I think it's a great question to do a PevMed search and see what's more common. But remember one of the statements I made earlier in the lecture, that it is the tumor microenvironment, the signaling environment, that often determines the behavior and the actions of mTOR. So, and I think this is a good example to remember that this is a symphony and a biosystem, and the expression of genes is influenced by many factors. So, so I don't know the answer to your question, but I think it'd be good to search for it. But what I can say is, it's probably different in different patients. And I don't think, in my experience, I've never seen a patient who is using herbs. Like, look at all the herbs we're using, right? We know that all these herbs are common in our treatment plans. We're not causing sarcopenia. We're solving it in most of our patients, right? We're not generally promoting cachexia, we're solving it. So because it's complex and we don't know enough to answer your question, I think we have to look at each patient. But, you know, think about the impact of mTOR on glycemic control and insulin receptors and IGF-1. So it has an impact, remember, on fibroblasts. And it affects so many pathways that I don't think there's a simple answer to your question. So then I go to my clinical experience, and I think not only about the fact that I always try to put botanicals that we commonly use so that you can feel like you don't have to get too exotic, that if you know a handful of botanicals and phytochemicals, you can understand how to do a lot, and then you might change dosing to emphasize certain pathways. And then we also know we're in the realm of safety. But my experience with patients who are on things like Afinitor and, you know, Sirolimus and Everolimus, I don't see those patients, when they start those drugs, start to tip into those physiologies. So that's just my experience, right? So so it's although it may change metabolism, it doesn't seem extreme. And we have to also look, these are tend to be more advanced patients. So if they're under our care, we're also doing other things that inhibit those. Mm-hmm. So it always comes back to that. There's not a silver bullet. There's not one pathway. But I love your question because it is important as clinicians to observe our patients. And if we see accelerated loss of muscle mass, we need to reevaluate what we're doing and reevaluate what's going on with the patient. So, but it's just in my clinical experience, I haven't seen that. I understand your thinking, and I'll bet there's a subset of patients for whom it's problematic. You know, it might be advanced diabetics. It might be the elderly who are already sarcopenic and can't easily build back muscle. You know, it may be a subset of patients somewhere.
It could also.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm also thinking, Dr. Choco, in that sense, because cancer does, the cachexia, it's multifactorial in its etiology. So maybe also the herbal formulations in its multifactorial effect also inhibit the other way, other pathways that would be promoting cachexia from tumor necrosis factor, cytokines, interleukins. So possibly it's more of that effect, and that is why we are not seeing the increase in cachexia when, in your experience, when using herbal formulations as opposed to only the mTOR inhibitors from pharmaceutical.
Right. Which aren't anti-inflammatory at all. Right.
So this is, I'm just thinking that way.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
why
are we
not tolerating that? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I also, the way I think also is, I'm a fairly middle path clinician. And so I always want to err on the side of safety with my patients. So when I look at what are the botanicals and phytochemicals that have been in use for 100, 200 years, and people don't get into trouble on them, then I think that we are in a safe territory. Of course, we are using high pharmaceutical type doses and combining lots of things, so we still have to observe our patients. But I think it's a question, an excellent question to ask and for us to learn about. And it always comes down to observing our patients well. And that includes, looking at biomarkers and looking at that tumor microenvironment and their cancer terrain to make sure we're not throwing them off, rather, but pushing them in the direction where we feel their cancer terrain is optimized. And so mm-hmm. if you're measuring that, you'll have a way to know if you're throwing somebody off and putting them at risk, or you're actually stabilizing them into a healthier, more cancer-resistant physiology,
right.
You know? So,
we
get the handholds,
teaching.
Right?
Yeah. Thank you for the podcast with Keith Flaherty. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, let me tell everybody about that because that's in your notes for this call. Thank you so much, Anna. That was such a great question.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah. We can still have conversation. We have time. But I have in the rest of the notes for this call a couple of very interesting papers, and I also put a link to a podcast. I just got introduced to Dr. Peter Attia, Attia, by my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Sarah Gottfried. She's very brilliant, and she turned me on to this podcast, and it just so happened that when I started to listen to it, there was a 2-hour deep dive into cancer titled The History of Oncology, Novel Approaches to Treatment, and the Exciting and Hopeful Future. And so you can just go to peterattia.com, and you can subscribe to his podcast, and then he's got a lot of different topics, but it's really an intelligent podcast. But this lecture, I just want to read a quote from Dr. Flaherty because it tells you the kind of mind he has, and this is what we need in oncology. We can't keep hitting the same pillar and expect that we're going to cure cancer. We need the activators of the immune system. We need the inhibitors of the activated oncogenes, like mTOR. We need the drugs that target epigenetic regulators, and we need the metabolic switch regulators. So here he is describing what we do. describing the framework out of which we function and think about our patients. And so this is an amazing lecture to listen to. It's a really interesting lecture. And so I really just wanted to let you all know about that. Just briefly, I have a paper here on coagulation and neoplasms to remind you how important it is to be monitoring D-dimer and CRP and fibrinogen in patients to make sure that they don't have a thrombotic event because they weren't being monitored. And there is a clinical pearl on hypercoagulation in your library if you are not aware of that. It is a really important topic to be well-versed about, and there's a new paper here. There's a wonderful paper I included was a survey of 4,000 cancer patients asking them how they felt about their care. And so it's very person-centered. It was done in Europe, not the United States, but it talks about cancer patients' frustrations and not having their psychological needs met, in not being taken seriously when they report their symptoms. One patient said, I don't want more information, I want better information. So this is, I think, a reflection on how much patients need our style of care, which is very person-centric and very individual care. And one of the things we do is help patients to navigate that very dehumanizing, depersonalizing environment. And I think that's one of our biggest roles, is to make sure patients get the proper diagnostic workups, that when they report symptoms that they're taken seriously. I have a patient right now who's developed a cough. She has lung metastasis. And the nurse said, oh, that's just a drug side effect. I said, she has lung mets. I think we need to look a little further than just being dismissive and saying, well, it's just a drug side effect. So sometimes we play that role, and it can be very important. Pardon me. She's in a HMO environment where care is minimal rather than optimal. And so those patients need to advocate for themselves, and we need to help them do that. There's a really fantastic paper that was published in 2017 titled The Role of the Tumor Microenvironment in Tumorigenesis. So again, this is our framework. So I'm just thrilled to see that in mainstream thinking, this is becoming more part of their thinking. And then I think I had one more paper. Oh, yes, I had another really interesting paper that I included here. And it's a very recent paper this year. And it's a review from the ASCO Post, which is an online newsletter of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. They have great stuff, and they have very clinician, user-friendly, practical stuff as well about, you know, patient management. They have a great page on cancer-related fatigue, for instance. So this review was based on a 2019 paper entitled Practice Preferences and Practical Tips from Primary Care Physicians to Improve the Care of Cancer Survivors. And it talks about the fact that primary care survivors don't have any training in caring for cancer survivors. And that's hence why this course, hence why what we all do for our patients is sorely needed, because there's all these patients being turned back to their primary care providers. And really, there is no training for primary care clinicians. And so I'm trying to make a small footprint on this side of the fence to have a way to think about it and a way to monitor and support these patients in a health model. And so this said 82% of the primary care providers who responded had been in practice for 10 years, and they only 10% of them felt that they were comfortable dealing with cancer survivors. So it's a great paper to demonstrate the value of what we're doing here in our community. So those are there for you. They'll be uploaded to the library along with a lot of the references that I used in the mTOR slides. They'll be uploaded for you also. So we have a little bit more time, I think. Let's take a few more minutes if anybody wants to bring up any topic or question of any kind, patient-centered research, just your own opinion, anything that anyone wants to share. Remember to press *7. Well, then we've come to the end of an hour. So again, thank you for your participation. send in your cases and your questions, and they'll be included in the next call if I get them 2 weeks from now. So thank you, everyone, and good night.